Okay, we're going to start on the citation number is 134, and it's from page 172 of Hayes' book. And, you know, she's continuing to examine how the biblical and then the rabbinic and then the Hellenized Jewish and then the Greek ideas of law change and how they transitioned over time so that we end up in the Western world with a very, very different notion than even first century Jewish thinking, and very different than the biblical idea. So we'll start on this citation where she says, Greco-Roman sources that identify the divine natural law with truth are making a claim about authenticity. Okay. Why is that important? Because they're not providing an apologetic. They're not providing evidence, right? They're making a claim about what is in alignment with what they consider the real. And so she says, divine natural law is true not because it has been validated by a recognized procedure or norm creation. That would be the equivalent of a canonizing committee. Right? What she's saying is divine natural law from a Greco-Roman perspective never had anybody to authorize it, to validate it, right? It's true because it conforms to substantive criteria of character, or more precisely, it is itself the criterion of authenticity for all other law. In other words, since the Greco-Roman view of law is that it is in alignment with the very nature of reason itself, it can't be validated by another reason because it is reason. Therefore, because it illustrates what reason actually means, all other laws are measured by it. Okay? So she says, it's not clear that the assertion that the Torah can be interpreted in 49 or 70 different or even contradictory ways is tantamount to the claim that the Torah is in its essence multiform. So now she's moving back and forth. She's saying, okay, for the Greco-Roman view, there is only one divine law. There's not multiple divine laws because there's only one reasoned explanation of the universe, only one rational cause, okay? Therefore, when the Torah says, when we looked at black fire, white fire, when the Torah says there's 364 million different ways to interpret the text, that means that it views what's happening in the Torah completely differently than the Greco-Roman idea, which in the Greco-Roman idea underlines our Western thought that there's only one right answer. Okay? Now, let's look at the next citation. Despite programmatic assertions of legal pluralism in rabbinic literature, and what she's saying there is that the rabbis had many different ways that they understood the text, many texts employ the term din, which means law or judgment, in order to signal the existence of a single authentic answer. A theoretical monism. However, in many instances, these texts go on to accord that answer scandalously little difference. And what she's saying is, if you really press the rabbis, you might get them to say, yeah, there can only be one true explanation, right? Especially Hellenistic Jewish rabbis. But she says, the point is that even if you press them into that corner, they would account for that with very little emphasis, because as far as they're concerned, the practical application of how you live is multiform. There's lots of different ways that you can live with the text. So that means, and she draws this conclusion in the next citation, divine law, this is from a rabbinic point of view, is not necessarily and essentially identical to the formal logical truth. In other words, this is going to be really hard to grasp, but what she's pointed out is if you follow the biblical, Jewish, rabbinic idea of the law, you can actually have logical contradictions in the law, and it's still the divine law. It doesn't have to be non-contradictory. It only has to be non-contradictory if you adopt a Greco-Roman view, which says that there can only be one true rational answer. Then any answer that you get that contradicts the one true rational answer must be wrong. But in the rabbinic idea, you can have contradictions, and that doesn't mean it's wrong, because the source of divine law for the rabbis is not reason, it's God. So if God tells you two different contradictory things, so be it, right? Okay? In short, she says, rabbinical literature of all periods, early and late, East and West, maintains a conceptual distinction between formally correct law produced by logical reasoning and the divine law as taught by scripture or elaborated in rabbinic halakha. The two may differ from one another in substance, or they may coincide in substance, suggesting that in the rabbinic view, divine law does not necessarily follow or coincide with the dictates of formal logic. Okay? This is really, really important, because what it says is, when we start to read the commandments, and when we read the Midrashim about the commandments in the Torah, we may come across explanations by the rabbis that seem totally contradictory to common sense and reason. Or we may find that the rabbis argue two different positions which cannot be reconciled. Okay? But from the rabbinic biblical point of view, that is not a criterion to dismiss the law. Because as far as the rabbinic literature is concerned, look what she says. Rabbinic literature in all periods, early and late, East and West. So consensus in rabbinic literature is, it doesn't have to make sense. It doesn't have to be logically correct. It doesn't even have to follow the evidence. It doesn't matter if it's not historically correct. It doesn't matter if you can't find the archaeology to support it. It doesn't matter if it has errors in it. It doesn't matter even if it's contradictory. It doesn't matter, because the divinity of the law does not depend on any human evidence or human thinking. Okay? Then she says in the next quote, the difference between the rabbinic and the Greco-Roman discourses of law and truth could not be more stark. In Greco-Roman discourse, the disjunction between law and truth holds only in the case of human law, not divine law. Okay? Remember the difference? Human law is the law of the community, of the state, okay, made up by consensus of human beings, subject to all kinds of error, corruption, not eternal, not static, not essentially true. It's whatever the convention is, okay, in that human law. But divine law in Greco-Roman thinking is completely the opposite. It's eternal, it's universal, it's static, and by the way, it is absolutely aligned with truth. Okay? Now, the difference between rabbinic and Greco-Roman law. She says divine law in the Greco-Roman world is self-identical with truth. In other words, if you were a Greek philosopher and someone argued that the law had contradiction in it, you would immediately claim that that cannot be the divine law, because the divine law is truth. Okay? But for the rabbis, she says, the distinction between law and truth as measured by the standard of formal logic holds even in the case of divine law. While divine law may align with the formally or logically correct law, this assignment is accidental, not essential. Right? Accidental. So accidentally, God's laws might make sense, but it's not essential. Okay? The authority of divine law is not undermined by its lack of conformity to a formal or logical standard. For the rabbis, the formal or logically correct law does not obligate. Right? So if you think your way into a reasonable ethics from a biblical perspective, that doesn't obligate you to do anything. Right? God's divine law obligates, not because it is true, but because its origin is in the divine will. And this goes all the way back to something that we looked at a long time ago in a book
I don't know if I have it here. No, it's by Weisengard. Oh, yeah, I do have it. It's this book.
Abraham's Promise. Okay? And what Weisengrod says, and it's really important, is the commandments are not laws. Okay? They're not a system of ethics. The commandments are predicated upon the will of the divine command giver. So they are religious, not ethical. Right? Do you see what I'm saying? The Greek Roman view of law, of divine law, is that it is ethically binding because it is rational. The biblical view is the only reason you keep the commandments is because it is religious. It's within the paradigm of a religious commitment. It does not necessarily have to be rational.
Hey, okay? Skip?
Yes.
I'm going to ask you something. This is something totally away. It's not. I'm just confused. Do you remember if I was on last week with you guys? Does anybody remember me being on?
Yeah.
Last Sunday? Okay, yeah. I'm really confused because I thought we left off back on page 60-something, and now we're on page 184. I'm so confused. Where did we lose all that time?
I'm pretty sure.
Am I wrong?
I'm pretty sure that we were at the citation number was 134.
No, that's impossible.
If I was on the same thing, because I had my notes open to page to note 64.
That's where
I wish somebody would have said something. Okay, we'll go on.
I was confused.
I thought for sure that we talked about Qumran, and we talked about the Mosaic Law in Qumran, and we talked about Philo of Alexandria. We didn't talk about that?
Well, we talked about Philo, but it was back on my last citation is 66 that I wrote on, and I'm like, I'm so lost. I was like, how did I lose 10 pages?
Okay, I haven't left off.
Is that right? Is everybody agreeing?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's right. Oh, okay, my mistake. Yep. Okay. All right, well, I'm thinking faster than you. Okay, so let's go. Okay, we'll go all the way back. Okay,
you always do anyway.
We'll go back to 64, right?
Skip, can you just repeat the name of that book, Abraham's what?
Abraham's Promise.
Promise, right? Okay, thank you.
Promise. There. Oh, you can't see it. It's Michael Weisengrod, Weisengrod. I've cited him before in today's word. He makes a really, yes, really important point about Adam. And what he says is that Adam doesn't keep God's commandments because they're law. He keeps them because they are the wish of the divine lawgiver. And I'm going to make this point and then we'll back up. That once you adopt a Greco-Roman view of law, and that the law is a rationally based ethics, then as Jacques Ellul says, then you don't need God. Because if you can come to a conclusion of what is right and wrong through reason alone, you don't need a divine command giver. And in fact, if you can come up to what's ethically correct without, or through reason, only through your reason, then the introduction of God as a divine command giver is completely superfluous, right? And that's pretty much where we are in the Western world. That's why Weisengrod makes the point that the biblical commandments are not rational ethics, legal rational ethics. They didn't come about because we thought of the best way to do things. They come about because there's a divine command giver, and the divine command giver is not subject to human reason. Okay, so that means, as Hayes points out, sometimes the laws make perfect sense. Thou shalt not murder. Okay, sometimes they don't make any sense at all, but it doesn't make any difference to the rabbis because there is no need for the biblical law to match up with rational thinking. Okay? Now, okay, so now we'll go back. We'll go back to...
I think it's 64, 65, it's like 67 or 68.
64.
Something.
64. Okay, so we'll go back. Did we talk about positive law represents a failure of education because a truly wise is not do not stand in need of laws themselves? I know we talked about this. Okay?
Yeah,
because my point was, this is the Western world. Look, here's the problem. Once sin is defined as a violation of law, as rather than a violation of the will of a divine command giver, once sin is related to law, then the problem with sin is not moral corruption. The problem with sin is lack of education, right?
Right.
Sin, in other words, sin is a violation of what everyone knows should be the case in a proper ethical system. So the idea that sin is somehow a moral commitment or moral mistake is eliminated. What really has to happen now is that people need to be educated. Because no rational man would ever do anything that was ultimately not in his benefit. And so if he does things that appear to be morally incorrect, it's only because he lacks the proper education to see what the true moral benefit is. And then he would stop doing it. Okay? Okay. Yes? Comment? No. Okay. So here's the point.
Question.
In the Western world, what we need is a better DSM-5. Not a deeper understanding of the biblical text. Do you understand what I'm saying? What I'm saying is sin is a mental disease. It's not a moral mistake. So what we need is a better DSM-5. Because what we really need to understand is why people make mental mistakes like theft and murder and social unrest and lying, and because if they really truly understood rationally, they wouldn't do those things. Okay? So that's her point about positive law represents a failure of education. That was number 65. So let's look at number 66. Proper education eliminated the need for positive law altogether because proper behavior flows naturally from the fine and good man. Legislation is thus superfluous for the good man. And this is Gauguin's noble savage, right? He doesn't need to be taught anything because once he aligns his will with the proper understanding of the cosmos, then he will do those things that flow from a rational understanding of what's good. He doesn't need to have legislation tell him what's good, okay? So now we're on 67. To conceive of law as instruction is to assume that non-virtuous acts stem from ignorance or erroneous ideas. This account of vice is found in Plato's early dialogues. I thought we talked about this one for sure, okay? In the Protagoras, Socrates holds that no one errs willingly, that mistakes in action are due to mistaken beliefs about the merits of desired ends. However, in Book 4 of the Republic, attributes vice not to a lack of knowledge, but to irrational parts of the soul, appetite and spirit, that have not been properly subjugated to the rational part of the soul. Okay? So what the result of Greek philosophy's influence on the church fathers and the development of the Catholic Church leads directly to catechism. Because what is catechism? A training in how to think properly so that your behavior will flow from proper thinking. Okay? That's what catechism is. It's not an understanding of the text. It's an understanding of what is rationally true so that your behavior will flow from that. Okay? And the result, of course, is two things. If you make a mistake, it's because you're ignorant, so you need more education. And if you continue to make mistakes, it's because your soul, part of your soul, is wrapped up in these irrational thoughts. Okay?
But doesn't the church believe in evil and the devil and all that? So how does that?
Okay. Let's back up. Okay, so Phyllis, In church theology, for centuries, evil was, I'll give you the definition of evil. Evil was the privation of good. In other words, evil was defined in terms of the absence of good. It didn't have a positive existence of its own. It only existed because, as the guy said, when good men do nothing, evil, you know, so the whole idea was that evil wasn't real. It was only the absence of good things that allowed people to have this experience of evil. But in fact, it didn't have any positive ontological status. Okay? And that falls right in line with what we've just talked about with Plato, where the real is the rational, and the irrational, what is not real, is what we experience as evil. Okay? That went on for a long, long time until the invention of the super powerful devil. And then all of a sudden you had an evil counterpart to God. And now you have the development of spiritual warfare, so that they're, you know, these cosmic characters battling it out, God and the devil. And now evil has a real substance, but it still comes from pagan ideas and Greek philosophy. It doesn't come from the biblical text. Okay. Let's go to the next. Yes.
Doesn't Paul talk about spiritual warfare? I mean, isn't he there very directly incorporating a pagan philosophy into his teachings?
Yeah, that's right. So the question with Paul, and I'm glad you brought it up. The question with Paul is, what does he mean by spiritual warfare? Okay. And I don't want to get too far off the subject because I've written about this in Today's Word. Either you'll see it soon or it's already been written about. I don't remember where. But the point is that there's a Gnostic element in this, because spiritual warfare in the first century had a whole bunch of stuff to do with Gnosticism, which comes out of the Stoic philosophy of the Greeks. Okay? And if you go look on my website under Gnosticism or spiritual warfare, you'll start reading about why Paul addresses this and what his audience would have thought. Not what we think 2,000 years later, not all of the hype that we got with the invention of the devil and all of his little demons running around. Thank you, C.S. Lewis. Okay. What Paul was thinking about was the audience that he was addressing in that letter. And that audience was familiar with the philosophy of the Greeks and how they viewed what was happening cosmologically in relation to the creation of the world and the relationship to God and the creation of man and the issues that were involved in the material and the spiritual. Okay. So yes, Paul uses the term spiritual warfare, but I'm pretty sure that he didn't mean what we think. I suggest you go take a look at that.
A lot of the churches have paintings of the angels fighting good against evil.
Yeah, of course. Of course. And they don't have paintings of Isaiah 45 where God says, I'm the author of good and evil. So true. That's a little more difficult. Remember, the rabbinic view is it doesn't have to be rationally coherent. Okay. So we have pushed... In the church, we push the rational is real idea to the point that our theology reflects only those things that we can rationally make sense of. And in relation to the law, that means that God's commandments become an ethical system that depends on how reasonable they are. Okay? That's why we can have an argument today about why you should not eat shrimp and talk about health, right? That it's not good for you, for your health. I don't think that the commandment has anything to do with that. I mean, it might be accidentally that it happens to be a healthy thing to do, but that wasn't the basis of the commandment. As soon as I start down the path of justifying the prohibitions over dietary laws on the basis of whether they're good for my health, I'm now in the Greek world where I'm looking for a rational explanation to a divine command. Okay, let's continue. What is a positive trait in the case of the perfect divine law, immutability, that is, never changes, is precisely a dangerous trait in the case of the imperfect human law, which does change. Human law, owing to its imperfection, must be flexible. Why? Because people make mistakes, because laws have problems, because they didn't think of everything. Okay? She goes on, because right and wrong depend on the particular circumstances of a case, and no human law can capture all the circumstances, it would be better to be ruled not by fixed human laws, but by sages, wise experts. Why? Because the wise experts don't pay any attention to the fixed human laws. They govern on the basis of reason alone. Okay. The 4th century BCE Pythagorean Archytas denigrates written law as lifeless in comparison to the animate law, the law of nature, embodied in the king, and maintains that the laws of political communities must be inscribed not on houses and doors, but in the living souls of citizens. And if you don't see, this is a 4th century BCE, if you don't see a direct attack against Moses in that citation, then you miss the point. Remember what God instructs Moses to do? Write this Torah on the doorposts of your house and on your gates, et cetera, et cetera, as though somehow the written human law expresses the character of the divine lawgiver. And what does this Greek say in the 4th century BCE? That's nonsense. The law, that the written law can never describe what is rationally and real, because that doesn't come about by writing it on houses and doors. Okay? For next citation, for Plutarch, a 1st century, 2nd century CE middle Platonist philosopher, the king is an incarnation of the divine logos and God's representative on earth. Okay? Now, why do I include that? Do you even care what Plutarch has to say? Probably not. But you will care if you see that the word logos, which we find in the first chapter of John and which becomes the basis for all kinds of theological proclamations and doctrines, is actually a Greek word that means the incarnation of rational law, of the natural law. And the king is supposed to be a divine representative of that law. So in the first century, when John uses the word logos, and we interpret it as a Greek text, a Greek piece of vocabulary, we miss the point of what John's trying to do, because we make John into a Greek. And in Greek, that word has a lot more impact than it ever did as a translation of a Hebrew word. Okay? You can see right away that the word contains in it this idea of an incarnation. Okay? All right, let's go on. Positive law, coercively enforced. Remember, positive law is human law, and human law has to be enforced with power, right? Positive laws, coercively enforced, are necessary only for those incapable of perceiving what is useful and beneficial and what is harmful, not for those who are able to engage in a rational calculation of what is useful and advantageous. In other words, if you're truly aligned with the universe, you don't need law, because your alignment with the universe will guarantee that you do the rationally right thing. Okay? The last thing you need is somebody to give you a law code.
Okay? Hey, Skip.
Yes.
Isn't that, though, what Jeremiah says back, you know, going back a couple citations, you know, that the law will be written on the hearts of man, and we won't need to have the law?
Ah, but he doesn't say we won't need to have the law. What he says is this, that the law, which is now written on stone, will be written on hearts of flesh, so that everyone will naturally do what the law requires without having been taught, right? So that everyone from king to servant will naturally follow the law because it has been written on their hearts, okay? What law is he talking about? The law of reason? No. He's talking about, remember, this is Jeremiah 33:30 or 31:33. He's talking about the covenant law, the law that God gave to Moses, right? He's not saying, oh my gosh, we're going to get rid of human law and now we'll just do those things that are rationally comprehensible. What he's saying is that the law that was given to Moses was originally written on stone tablets. And now in the millennial kingdom, that same law will now be written on the hearts of men. So they won't ever have to worry about not following it. It'll be the natural thing that they do. But the natural thing that they do will be the commandments given to Moses by God. Okay?
Yeah, makes sense.
Well, let's go to the next one. The Athenian text of the 5th century BCE. I think for the first time, this is, by the way, this is a quote from an Athenian 5th century BCE text. Okay? I think for the first time, some shrewd and clever, that's sophist, individual, invented fear of the gods for mortals so that the wicked would have something to fear even if their deeds or words or thoughts were secret. In this way, therefore, he introduced the idea of the divine, saying that there is a divinity strong with eternal life who in his mind hears, sees, thinks, and attends to everything with the divine nature. Okay? And what, of course, this is 5th century BCE Greek, right? What he's saying is, I need a fable. I need a fictitious, omniscient, eternal, omnipresent God who sees everything so that the wicked will be afraid of him and they'll do the right thing. It doesn't mean that it's real. I just need to make this up, so that people will be afraid of a potential God who will see what they do in secret and therefore be worried about punishment, okay? She goes on. What ensures the law's stable and irreversible quality and thus serves as its savior? Persons possessing a suitable education, a belief in the soul's dateless anteriority, to and the sovereignty over the world of bodies, and a desire to discern the reason or logos that orders the heavens. Okay, this is from Plato's Laws. So that's a citation from Plato. Okay, and the whole point is that one more time you see that the answer to sin is not a religious answer, but a rational answer. You need education, and in addition to which, you need an eternal soul, the soul's dateless anteriority, which means the soul is forever, okay? And the soul is more important than the body. You see this? And sovereignty over the world of bodies. And there's a material world that's simply temporal, and what you want to do is align your existence to the spiritual world. You want to graduate toward logos only on the basis of logos.
We lost you there for a minute.
Okay. So she goes.
We lost
that sentence. Dennis?
We lost that sentence because you froze.
Oh, you lost it. Oh, I froze. Okay. Okay. Well. Okay, so I just will back up for a second and say, what you can see what happens in Plato, right? In Plato, there's a separation of the spiritual and the material, right? So the spiritual has to have sovereignty over the material. You want to leave the material world behind and graduate to the spiritual world. The spiritual world is the manifestation of logos, a pure reason, which is in alignment with the cosmic order, okay? And of course, that requires also the eternal existence of the soul. The belief that the soul's dateless anteriority, which Plato believed that all souls lasted forever. And not that they were, not that you were born and then your soul went on forever, but that your soul was always in existence and it just was manifest into a body temporally for a while. And then when your body died, the soul went back into heaven where it originally came from, right? Okay, so the next one, 74. The Greeks enjoyed the rule of law, written law in particular, which was understood to be an essential precondition for freedom. Okay, but this is interesting because even though they practically enjoyed the rule of law, Athens, Sparta, etc., the philosophers claimed that that was nothing more than human convention, right? It helped them establish a society based on free choice, but it didn't mean that it was in alignment with the cosmic order. So she says in the next one, by the Hellenistic period, the idea of prescriptive written law as a necessary mark of civilization was deeply entrenched, okay? So what does that mean? That in spite of the philosophers, Greek politicians, Greek theoreticians of civilization, Greek kings and princes realized that you had to have written law. And she says, subjugated peoples who internalized Hellenistic conventions had to defend their native customs as a prescriptive law or be labeled barbarian. So here comes the motivation for Hellenistic Jews to try to convince the world that Moses was in alignment with the cosmic order of the universe, right? Because if you couldn't convince the Hellenistic thinkers that your ethics was in alignment with the universe, then it was considered barbarian, right? It wasn't enforceable. Okay, so centuries later, Cicero would assert that Rome had, through the course of time and by dint of reason and long experience, developed a code of laws that measured up to the ideal standard of natural law, with the result that the laws of Rome should apply universally and permanently without change. Okay, Cicero is the same guy who said, I can't quote it exactly, but I give you the gist, that Rome was no more punitive or violent toward its conquered people than was necessary to bring them civilization. So the Roman view of this whole thing is, we have natural law inscribed in our human law because the two align. And that means that we, Rome, are the final version of what it means to have a civilization, and everyone else must conform. Okay? And by the way, that's Cicero is 100 in the year 100. So he's contemporary with Yeshua and Paul. So all this political stuff is going on at the same time, where Cicero is basically arguing that Rome is the final human exemplar of what it means to be civilized. Okay, let's go on. In the Hellenistic period, Jews, whose sacred writings contained a very different set of discourses about divine law, experienced a cognitive dissonance arising from the encounter with a conception of divine law so different from the representation of divine law in biblical tradition. Attempts by adherents of biblical tradition to make sense of biblical divine law in the light of the very different classical discourses of divine law gave rise to the process of negotiation, accommodation, resistance, and revision that would forever change the way biblical cultures would read the biblical text. Okay? A long paragraph, but really important, because what she says is, when Rome presented this final view of human society, the ultimate view of human society, the Roman way, okay? When Rome presented itself in those terms, during the Hellenistic period, it caught Jews off guard. And the Jews had to scramble to either accommodate or revise or correct or do something with their issue or their view of divine law so that it would match up with Rome. Okay? Where it did match up, the Jews became Hellenized. Where it did not match up, the Jews became resistant to Rome. So on the one side, Hellenized Jews were recognized as a part of the Roman Empire. Those Jews that resisted on the basis of divine law were considered barbarians and were never accepted into the Roman Empire and ultimately became enemies of Rome. Okay? So she goes on. The Hebrew Bible portrays the Mosaic law as possessing some qualities associated with natural law and some qualities associated with positive human law as defined by Hellenistic philosophical traditions. So, when the Greeks looked at the biblical law, the commandments, the books of Moses, they saw some things in there that looked like they aligned with the Greek concept of natural law, the divine, unwritten, permanent, forever, you know, immutable law, okay? But they also saw a whole bunch of things that looked like human law, made-up conventions. Don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. Made-up conventions that didn't make any sense to them at all. So from there, from the Hellenistic point of view, the Mosaic code was a mix of good things and bad things, and you had to separate those out, and that's where Philo goes to work on trying to show that the Mosaic code is aligned with the Greek idea of natural divine law. Not always successfully. That's why he has to use allegory, okay? But what it does is it puts the traditional biblical rabbi in opposition to the Hellenism of the first century, or the fourth century BC through the fourth century CE. So she says, the Hellenistic dichotomy of divine law and human law is a poor fit for biblical divine law. Although the Mosaic law is understood to be divine law, it possesses few of the features associated with divine law and many of the features associated with human positive law in the classical tradition. This incongruity was likely a cause of cognitive dissonance for many Jews. How were they to negotiate the differences between the biblical conception of divine law and the conceptions of divine law in the dominant culture? That is, it sets up the conflict between Hellenism and the Mosaic Code. And that conflict never goes away, and ultimately, it manifests itself in revolts against the Roman way of life and in the suppression of Rome over the Jewish ideas, okay? As she goes on, the difference between the universal law grounded in reason, that's the Greek side, and the particular Mosaic law grounded in will, divine will. They accomplished this, the Jews accomplished this reconciliation by one, drawing a strong correlation or even identification between Torah and either wisdom, Sophia, or reason, Logos, from Proverbs chapter 8, which are understood to inform the cosmic order, and two, transferring the properties of one to the other. In other words, Hellenistic Jews latched onto the idea of wisdom in Proverbs 8 and tried to show that the Mosaic Code was the expression of this deep sense of cosmic wisdom. And where they couldn't do that, they used allegory to try to minimize the differences. Okay, Plato asserts that the law is in need of a savior. In the Wisdom of Solomon, remember, okay, where does the Wisdom of Solomon come from? What's the date of the Wisdom of Solomon? The Wisdom of Solomon and First Enoch and Jubilees and Baruch and Syriac and all of these books are written during the Hellenized during the Hellenized Empire. So they all occur. They're all written between, say, the second century BCE and the first century CE. Right, that 300-year period. And of course, during that 300-year period, the dominant culture is Greco-Roman with this view of natural law that comes out of Greek philosophy. So these books, which we now call the Apocrypha, are attempts by authors to minimize the differences between the Mosaic code found in ancient pre-Babylonian scripture with the Greco-Roman culture. And that means they're going to have to redefine all kinds of categories and use all kinds of ways to match up with the dominant philosophical culture of the day was. Okay? And we're going to talk about Paul in the process. Okay? So, in the Wisdom of Solomon, the clear implication is that without the instruction of wisdom, without knowledge of God's commandments and of what is pleasing to God, virtue is not possible. Humans are not delivered from sin. They do not gain immortality. Paul, of course, will move in the same direction. Isn't that interesting that she would say that? Okay? Because what she's saying is, Paul follows the course of Hellenism. My view of Paul is just exactly the opposite, that Paul is a reformer and wants to go back to Moses. But her view of Paul is that he writes in such a way that Hellenizes what Moses had said. Okay? Let's look at the next one. In 1 Enoch, the laws regulating the cosmos are presented not as the manifestations of the logos inherent in nature, rather, they are commandments issued by God to regulate the cosmos. Okay, what's the attempt in 1 Enoch? The attempt in 1 Enoch is to show that God's creation is in alignment with the rational understanding of the cosmos. In other words, I'm not going to try to say, oh my gosh, the cosmos has its own inherent logic. What I say is that God made the logic in the cosmos, therefore making God reasonable. Okay? That's the next one. The possibility of cosmic disobedience that results from this torification of nature is a remarkable departure from classic notions of natural law. In other words, the biblical idea is that the cosmos can rebel against God. But of course, if the cosmos is reason, and reason can't rebel against itself, so from a Greek perspective, the idea of a cosmos in disobedience with its creation is nonsensical. Reason can't rebel against itself. But in the biblical account, the cosmos seems to be in opposition with the divine creator. And therefore, I've got to figure out a way to manage that. Okay? So she says, in Stoic thought, for example, the universe operates in accordance with the orthos logos, inherent within it, the idea of nature being acting against itself or against its inherent reason would be nonsensical. But in 1 Enoch, the cosmic order by which the universe operates is not a fundamentally inherent reason or logos that governs naturally or inevitably. On the contrary, cosmic order is here recast as a divine command issued to subjects, the elements and entities of the natural world that can choose to obey or and thereby incur punishment. Okay? Why do you need to know that? Because that's the beginning of Gnosticism, right? So the Gnostic answer, I don't know if we're going to get to the Gnostic answer or not, but the Gnostic answer is, you're right. The true God, the God of reason, is not responsible for the creation. That there's a whole bunch of demigods. There are 10 levels. The true God is the pure, unadulterated, immutable, static, universal reason. But when he issued the command to create, it was passed down through all these demigods, and they unfortunately introduced corruption into the levels, so that by the time we get to the world, it's totally corrupt, and the materiality of the world is its real problem. If we really want to get back to the true God, we have to get rid of all of the demigods in between who created all this corruption. And by the way, Yahweh in the Old Testament is one of those demigods. He is responsible for the evil in the world, not because he's the one true God, but because in the Bible, he's just one of the demigods that created all this mess. Okay? So you can see that the Gnostic answer is really appealing to those people who incline toward Greek philosophical ideas. Because what it says is, okay, so I've got the Bible, but it's really a history of all these corrupt gods and corrupt people creating corrupt things so that the universe is a mess. But that's not the responsibility of the one true, spiritual, immutable, eternal, rational God. Okay? So she goes on. A concept of law, according to which the cosmic order and Israel's law constitute but one reality. So for the Gnostics, there's other realities. And the ultimate reality is Plato's idea that the good, the true, and the beautiful are completely in the spiritual world and not subject to any of the corruption that happens in the material creation. One more quote. Other works focus on reason as well as wisdom. The result is a refashioning of Mosaic law that echoes the Hellenistic discourse of universal divine law. In other words, the Hellenistic Jews went out of their way to try to accommodate the biblical law to the philosophical law of the Greeks. Okay? And by the way, the reason that that's important to know is because the church does exactly the same thing. The church fathers are Hellenists. So they are going to read the biblical text in light of the Greek concepts of the of Hellenistic culture. Okay, now we finally get to Philo. It is Philo of Alexandria who goes the furthest in resolving the cognitive dissonance between Greco-Roman and biblical conceptions of divine law. And Philo of Alexandria, by the way, is a Jew. Okay, he asserts that the identity of the two, he asserts the identity of the two, and then labors to demonstrate that the Torah of Moses possesses all of the properties and qualities of Greek natural law. It is self-identical with universal truth, which entails its rationality, its immutability, and its unwritten character. Philo argues that the law of Moses, given by God, is superior to other law codes because of its identity with the law of nature. Did you get that? It's not superior because God gave it. It's superior because it is ultimately reasonable. And hence, it is by following the law of Moses that man can become saved? No, man can become a citizen of the world. Okay? Why? Why am I a citizen of the world? Because, according to Philo, the law of Moses is universal. It applies to everyone because it is ultimately rational. And therefore, anyone who follows it will become a citizen of the true world, which is the world of reason. Philo describes the narrative context of the law as consisting of two key elements, the creation account and the patriarchal history, omitting entirely the story of the Exodus from Egypt, the law's bestowal, and a special covenant with Israel. So Philo picks and chooses what he wants, right? And what he wants is the creation and Genesis 12 to 50. The rest of it he leaves out because it sounds just too human. Okay? For Philo, she says, the divinity of the text did. Oh, I think that's supposed to say did not. Yeah. Sorry, my mistake. Did not remove it. I can't go check the book because the book is in the United States. Oh, well. The divinity of the text did not remove it from the realm of literature and guaranteed its correspondence to truth. These truths are exposed through allegorical readings. In other words, wherever Philo came across something that he couldn't reconcile with the Greek philosophers, he changed it into an allegory. The identification of Torah of Israel with Stoic divine law entailed not only its truth, but also its eternal and unchanging character. For Philo, the purpose of law is not merely to command what is right and prohibit what is wrong, but to instruct the people in matters of doctrine and philosophy. Do you see the shift? The shift is not that law is no longer there to prevent sin. Right? Law is there to what? To educate, to instruct the people in matters of doctrine and philosophy so that they will live according to their reason. In other words, Abraham didn't merely obey the law. He, like the other patriarchs, was an embodiment of the natural law. Abraham was law, endowed with life and reason, flesh and blood. And he is himself a law and an unwritten statute. Okay? So, as far as Philo is concerned, Abraham is the incarnation of rational ethics. By declaring the Mosaic Law to be a copy of the law of nature that was observed intuitively by the patriarchs, Philo opens the door to a view that the life of virtue is accessible outside the specific written enactments of the Mosaic Law. How is it accessible outside? Because all it requires is that you understand truly what reason requires. The Mosaic Law becomes a divine concession bestowed upon those whose failings or weaknesses prevent them from obeying the law of God as conveyed by nature. Okay? And you can see Philo's incredible influence on the early church fathers, because the early church fathers say the same thing. The Mosaic Law was written for the Jews because they couldn't handle what God really wanted, which was a spiritual identification, right? And the fact that the Jews lost their privileged status came about because they were not willing to follow God's Messiah, right? You can see this reflected in the verse that suggests that the Jews had a veil over their faces so that they couldn't understand what was happening, right? The same thing that Philo is saying. The Mosaic Law was given for people who were too weak to think their way into a rational ethics. Okay, two more things. An inherent problem attends to the identification of Torah and universal wisdom or reason. If the Torah is identical with reason or with wisdom, the same wisdom that expresses the universal order of the creation, then how can it be the possession of one particular people? In other words, the reason that Philo has to ignore everything from Exodus to Malachi is because if the universal law is universal, then it can't be given just to Israel. There can't be God's chosen people. God is the true God, the spiritual, rational God, is in favor of all people, and therefore the story of Israel is merely an anecdote to tell us what happens when people aren't educated enough to understand the true rational God. Okay? And finally, he says, the wisdom that is revealed in divine Torah, that is in the possession of Israel, but the great works of God's creation are beyond the understanding of humankind. Israel should occupy herself with and reflect upon the law and the commandments, revealed wisdom, rather than pursuing wisdom's cosmic mysteries, which can deceive and distract the mind. So from Philo's perspective, Israel is an example of a people who just weren't up to the job. They weren't capable of truly understanding the cosmic mysteries. You can remember that Paul talks about this as well. I mean, all this language they pick up from Paul, right? Yeah, that Israel wasn't capable of understanding those things. And so God had to concede and give Israel human instruction. But the true God of the Bible is a God beyond all that, as exemplified in the fact that Abraham never had the covenant and still was righteous. Okay? Okay, we're going to stop here because now she moves toward the Qumran community, which, of course, is in the first century BCE. And we'll see how Qumran develops the same idea because they're still in the same environment, right? They live in the dominant culture of Hellenism, and they also represent a way to deal with the Mosaic Code in spite of that dominant culture. And Qumran's position is different than Philo. So we'll see how that develops tomorrow. All right. Any immediate questions before I have to cut it off today?
Yeah, Skip. Got a quick question here. How did Philo deal with Abraham's offering up of Isaac if Abraham is the embodiment of the natural law? Because that would be a contradiction to the natural law.
Yeah, but don't forget allegory. You can always take those stories and turn them into an allegory. And besides, what does the text say? The text tells the reader that this was a test. So as far as the story is concerned, it's really not about a violation of the natural law at all. It's just a test. It's just to see if Abraham really incorporated that deeper philosophical understanding so that he would demonstrate a proper attitude toward the one true God. Not the God that asks him to sacrifice the son, but this higher principle. Okay, we can go. You can go back to Philo. Philo wrote thousands of pages of stuff. You can go back and take a look and see how Philo deals with that. But don't forget, he's going to use allegory wherever he can't get the text to match up exactly. Okay? Anybody else?
Yep. Hi, Skip. I've got a question.
Yes, go.
Plato and Aristotle, where did they get this Greek idea, philosophy?
Wait, you're asking me where Greek philosophy came from? It's a miracle of humanity that in the 5th century BCE, suddenly Greeks start asking about how does the world work? How do we explain nature? And they moved away from mythological explanation, spiritual divine intervention of gods, and they moved toward what we now call the scientific method. And Aristotle, Plato came first, of course, and then Aristotle followed him, but they were basically scientists who started thinking about what does it mean to have a physical universe without a divine presence. Okay, that's a long, long story. You want a very long history on that one. I think I did a lecture once called the History of Western Epistemology or something, but it's 2,500 years of development. Yeah, I can send you some stuff about that. Okay, so we're done with the recording.